From the secrets we keep to the lies we tell ourselves, get ready to challenge the status quo and dare to ask the questions others are too afraid to ask. Welcome to the Francesca Luca Show. Join Francesca as she ignites a meaningful conversation about things that really matter. Buckle up and get real. Now, to give you something to talk about all week long, here's Francesca.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Super, super interesting guest tonight. When you're Nicole Brown Simpson's ex-boyfriend, yep, that's who we're talking to tonight, your life is forever marked by heartbreak, loss, and what could have been. Keith Zlomsowicz waited more than 30 years to tell his story and stalked. It could have been me. He shares the threats, the stalking, and emotional turmoil that he and Nicole endured at the hands of O.J. Simpson, and how in that fateful moment, it very well could have been him instead. Most people think they know Nicole's story, the headlines, the trial, the verdict. Tonight, you'll hear it from someone who lived it firsthand. He's here with me now via telephone. Welcome to the Francesca Luca Show, Keith. So glad to have you here with us.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks for the platform.
So you waited more than 3 decades to tell this story. Why now? What changed for you?
Quite honestly, I didn't think it was prudent to write the story when OJ was still alive.
That makes sense.
Things in the book that aren't very flattering to him. Personal details about our stalking events that we endured, Nicole and myself, and also a lot of stuff that Nicole, told me about in their prior relationship before I had ever met her that, doesn't paint a very flattering portrait of OJ. So I guess subconsciously I waited all these years here for my own safety. Mm-hmm. And when he passed away a year and a half ago or so, the media sort of came out of the woodwork hunting me down. I was in the Bahamas. I didn't think anybody knew where I was at. But I just sort of said to myself, there's still such an interest in it. And I never really got to fully tell Nick's side of our story. And I like to speak for her whenever I can. So all those factors combined and the fact that he was no longer on this planet and I didn't have to worry about him anymore sort of pointed me in that direction.
So you dated her after OJ?
Yes, I met her basically right when she left OJ. As a matter of fact, I met her in Aspen, Colorado, and some of the first words out of her mouth the day I met her was that she had come to Aspen to escape her abusive husband.
But did she say her abusive husband was?
She did not. I found out later that evening. I invited her and her friends in for dinner at my restaurant, Metzaluna, in Aspen, because I was smitten by her immediately. Wanted to sort of spend some time with her and get to know this lovely lady a little better. She had dinner at my restaurant with her friends, and then she came up to me after dinner and said, "You want to go out, hang out, and maybe do a little dancing, get to know each other better?" And we did. Well, it was during that time out later in the evening where a friend of mine approached me when she was on the dance floor and said, "Wow, dude, that's OJ's wife." And that's how I found out.
When
she came back to the dance floor, I said, "So the abusive husband you're escaping from LA is OJ Simpson." And she went, "Well, I guess you know now, the cat's out of the bag." And
how did you feel at that moment?
Well, at that moment, I wasn't very concerned because, as I talk about in the book, my restaurants were pretty well celebrity driven. A lot of A-list celebrities. OJ wasn't really even on my radar as a celebrity. Mm-hmm. I had heard, I guess, if I thought about it, some tales of stuff that had happened between them in the past, but it wasn't very well publicized at that point. So when she said an abusive husband, you don't initially know how to take that. It's really as our relationship progressed and I started to witness, OJ's behavior firsthand and hear about it from her own mouth about prior incidents that I started to realize this is a scary individual. And, that's the emphasis of the book. The title of the book is Stalked, It Could Have Been Me, because I truly feel it could have been me.
So at any point in the relationship, were you afraid for your life?
It's hard to say that I was actually afraid for my life because I was pretty cavalier. I was in love with Nick and I wanted to protect her and I wanted her to feel safe. So I stood my ground when it came to OJ. The times that he stalked us and followed us and confronted us and got angry with us, I always sort of just stood my ground and said, I don't care. She's single. She lives in her own place of residence. The divorce is pending. It's like this happens to people every day. So
right.
I wanted to be there for her. So I guess to answer your question, I didn't feel at that time that he was capable of what he actually did on June 12th of 94. She did warn me on occasion that several times she looked me in the eye and said, there's two OJ Simpsons, the one everybody sees and the one that no one sees. And she says, you don't want to be around that one because you don't know what he's capable of. And I kind of witnessed it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then obviously to see what he did on June 12th.
You were with her right up until that June 12th.
Well, no. No, we went through varying cycles. We had a 2 or 3 month romantic relationship after we first met.
Yeah.
That turned into about a year and a half incredible friendship. And that's because of his stalking and his overbearing, monitoring of our relationship. So I only spent short periods of time in Los Angeles because of my restaurants. I had 3 in LA and 2 in Aspen, but my primary residence was in Aspen where I met Nick. Mm-hmm. So when I came out to Los Angeles a few months after meeting her, we understood that I was only there for a finite period of time. And that's when our relationship heated up and we became sort of boyfriend, girlfriend. And we're going through all those phases that people go through when they're dating and mm-hmm. getting to know each other, with the understanding that in mid-May, I'd be heading back to Aspen for my normal cycle. So we went through the stalking and the confrontations with OJ. And then one last time in May, when he made it impossible for us to be together, we just sort of looked at each other and said, wow, he's not going to let this happen. And
what did he do?
Well, we agreed that we would just sort of cool things between us and see where.
No, what did OJ do?
Well, that last particular time, we had taken the kids down to Laguna Beach, to the beach house for the day, where we were going to spend time with Nick's whole family, her sisters and her mother and father. So OJ, finding out about this, he was out of town, but he had one of his detectives or whoever follow us or inform him where we were at. So he found out we were in the beach house in Laguna, and he called and went crazy over the phone on me and on her sisters. And then he called the Browns' house and went crazy on her parents. And it turned into just a big, huge thing. And the last thing I wanted was for her family to be exposed to what we had been going through. Mm-hmm. So we sort of walked down the beach at the end of the day and sat on a rock as the sun was going down and looked at each other and said, he is just not going to let this happen. And we just decided I was going back to Aspen. So let's just see where things went. We were going to cool the romantic part of our relationship and stay great friends. And it turned out to be one of the best friendships of my life. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is Nick really only had about an 18-month period of her adult life where she had some freedom to sort of, grow into her woman. She met OJ at 18.
I didn't know that.
Hmm. Yeah, they were together and, as boyfriend, girlfriend while he was still married to his prior wife. And then they got married. So there was about 15 years of her life that were consumed by OJ, his overbearing personality. When she decided to leave him in 92, I was fortunate enough to meet her right away. And I could see her trying to blossom into this area that she hadn't had a chance to. And then, that year and a half when we were romantic and then best friends before the ill-fated reconciliation with OJ, which ultimately cost her life, I was fortunate to be there for that whole thing. And then when they started the reconciliation, I was well aware of that. We were best friends talking on the phone every day, sometimes a couple times a day. And she told me that they were considering it. I was against it, but I wanted her to make her own decisions. That was part of that 18-month period. She was trying to figure out things for herself. He convinced her he had changed. He had been to therapy. He duped her, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But all she really wanted was that family unit, the father of her children, that whole thing that you grow up envisioning,
How many children did she have with him?
Two with him. Mm-hmm. Sydney was a few years older than Justin, but mm-hmm. that meant everything to her. So she was willing to roll the dice one last time to see if there was one last ditch effort that could make it work and get that family unit together. I advised against it, obviously, but
you loved
strong.
Her as well.
Yeah. I loved her as well. And I always thought there was a chance we would get back together from a romantic standpoint. But I let her make her own decision on that. Obviously, she was going to do that anyway. But I tried to talk her out of it somewhat, but not aggressively enough. So when they tried the reconciliation, then it was our frequency of phone calls and became a lot further apart because I could never call the house thinking he might be there. If he heard my voice, he would go crazy. We all know that October 93 911 tape that is mm-hmm. probably the most played a piece of evidence from the trial mm-hmm. where he's kicking in the back door. He's screaming my name, mm-hmm. And he's tearing up her phone book and all the pictures of us. And that was because my name was mentioned on the set of a movie that day. He hadn't seen me for a year, hadn't talked to me, hadn't confronted me for a year prior to that. And that's the kind of reaction he had, that he went to her house and broke down the back door. And you can hear the anger in his voice and the fear in hers during that 911 tape. And that forced us to not speak again. 3 days later, when we finally got in touch with each other, she told me that something horrible had happened, that they had had a confrontation and that the sound of my name made him absolutely crazy, and that if they were going to, she was going to give 100% to this reconciliation, that she told him she would not speak to me anymore, that he demanded it. So I lost my best friend on that day, and that's the last time I ever spoke to Nick, and that was in October of 93. And the next time I saw her, I was holding her casket at her funeral.
And how many months later was that? Six?
That was in June of 94. So, you know, that's eight months. Yeah. Whatever that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no communication for those 8 months, not knowing what was going on in her day-to-day life. And then obviously, you know, waking up on June 13th and finding out she's been murdered and speaking to the family immediately and them asking me to fly out. I was in Atlanta on business when it happened. Asked me if I could be there as a pallbearer. So I immediately came out and saw the family at the funeral. So imagine, if you can, my emotions for not seeing the woman I loved for 8 months, holding her casket at the funeral while standing next to the man who killed her, knowing that he did because he was still a free man and I was a pallbearer. So we were in 1 foot of proximity to each other.
You did know at that time, you were sure that he had
killed her? In my heart, I was sure. I mean, everybody that knew of their relationship and knew of the prior acts was confident that he either directly or had somebody else do it. But as the, you know, the bits of evidence started to be leaked, you know, blood trails here, bloody glove here, timeline works out. Of course, we all thought that. And he didn't get arrested until the day after the funeral. So he was a free man standing right next to me as we were laying her into the ground. And I had to deal with those emotions. And then finding out from her family at the funeral that they were talking about me that night at dinner, 2 hours before she was murdered, after not speaking to me for 8 months, that she told her family she was going to surprise me. I didn't know if that meant a phone call or she was going to visit me in Aspen. But like I said, imagine my emotional state of mind at that funeral as all that's taking place.
And this is now 32 years later. And it seems, I can't imagine how you still must feel.
I loved her. And I think I always will. I never got married. I never had children. I sort of, the rest of the relationships in my life, I could never really take to that next level. I had some great tips with some great women over the years, but just couldn't commit to that next level. So here I am, 60, pushing 65 years old, single, childless, and missing her as much as I ever have.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is just so, so tragic. You write that you cherished every moment with her. What do you think people still most misunderstand about Nicole?
Well, she was an incredible mother, and she was just the funnest person to be around. They never really talk about Nicole as a person. They talk about her as an entity, as OJ's wife. They don't humanize her. She was hysterical. She was lighthearted. She was funny. I'll tell you silly things. She used to eat onions like they were apples.
Oh, gross.
Isn't that crazy, though?
And then you would kiss her? Yuck.
Yeah, but it didn't happen. That's how much I loved her. But that's just a funny little thing that I remember so vividly. She'd snap her gum all the time. She was addicted to lip gloss. Loved a good shot of tequila every now and then. And in the afterlife, when I see her, I hope that's the first thing she has waiting for me.
Oh, my goodness.
You know.
So how many years in total were you with her?
Well, like I said, the romantic part was only about 3 months, but a year and a half of incredible friendship, and then another 6 months of friendship, but less communication because of OJ.
Right.
And then she's murdered 6 months after that. So
that's a short period of time to have been with someone and then still not being able to take that next step with another woman.
That tells you what my true emotions were.
I mean, absolutely.
And obviously the circumstances of what happened and,
right,
you know, 3 years of my life was consumed with, you know, the murders, the aftermath, the preliminary, the trial. I was under subpoena for both the prosecution and defense for over a year, and then involved in the civil trial and the custody trial and all the aftermath from that. So it was a whirlwind of emotions and events that didn't really clear up. And then I started to grieve after the crazy of it all. So
do people know you as Nicole Brown Simpson's ex-boyfriend?
Not as much.
Like if you met somebody, would they know this?
You know what? It's funny. Sometimes I'll be in a random spot. I was in the Bahamas 6 months ago, and a woman walked up to me at a lounge bar and said, I recognize you, and I can't quite place it. And her girlfriend talked about it a little bit, and they realized who I was. And so that silly stuff like that happens on occasion. And then obviously early on when I was under subpoena, when everyone knew who I was because of my grand jury testimony and, you know, the Barbara Walters and Connie Chung and National Enquirer is offering me $1 million in cash and I'm getting book offers and I'm getting all these interview offers. I was the big story back then. Yeah. So I ended up in New York City just to sort of get away from that. I was hiding out to testify in Tampa area where I'm originally from. And I was having to sneak out of the house I was staying at in the trunk of cars just to go have dinner without the media.
Yeah.
And I'd shaving in the morning and open my bathroom window blinds and there'd be a camera, you know, pointing through it and craziness like that. So I sort of went to New York City because I felt I could blend in into that madness that New York City is. And people didn't care. You know, celebrities can walk down the street in New York and not get.
Right. Exactly. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, you talked about Nicole and, you know, some of these habits and whatnot, but I understand and appreciate that she wanted to see if she could, you know, bring the family back together. But I also, in the back of my mind, question her level of self-esteem or self-worth. And I'm just curious about your thoughts on that. So just marinate on that for a few minutes while we hear from our sponsors, and then we will be right back. Listeners, don't go anywhere. Fascinating story we've got. There's a certain feeling you get when you walk into Pioppi's. It's comfortable, familiar, like being welcomed by family. And that makes sense, because Pioppi's is a family business. Started right in Plymouth by Tony Pioppi after Prohibition, passed down through generations, and still run today by the same family. This is the kind of place where people take the time to help you, where questions are encouraged, where recommendations are personal because they actually get to know you. You might stop in for a bottle of wine and find yourself discovering a new favorite bourbon, checking out the craft beer wall, or browsing a humidor for hand-rolled cigars. For over 90 years, Pioppi has been about more than what's on the shelves. It's about pride, tradition, and taking care of the community they call home. Visit Pioppi's Package Store at 183 Court Street in Plymouth and follow them on Instagram and Facebook for new arrivals and events. So the next time you need a little whining, visit Pioppi's. Family owned, Plymouth rooted, no whining allowed. For 25 years, Andorra Salon has been making the South Shore feel beautiful. And today, it's also your destination for stylish women's fashion. I know because I wouldn't go anywhere else. Andorra is where I always feel my most beautiful. Discover a curated boutique filled with flattering, easy-to-wear pieces you'll love reaching for again and again. From casual chic to something a little more special, Andorra makes getting dressed feel effortless and fun. And when you're ready to complete the look, their experienced team offers expert hair and makeup services personalized just for you, all in one relaxing, welcoming space. Located at 82 Main Street in Kingston, Andorra delivers an elevated fashion and beauty experience designed to help you feel comfortable, confident, and completely yourself. Visit AndorraSalon.com today. That's A-A-N-D-O-R. Salon and be on your way to a new you. Shop the boutique, refresh your style, love the way you look. You'll be glad you did. Worn carpet fibers, ground in dirt, heavy use. When dirt settles deep into your carpets and upholstery, or when your home or business needs a complete clean, it takes experience, precision, and the right tools to get it right. When you need a cleaning detective, that's Sherlock Holmes Cleaning. At Sherlock Holmes Cleaning, they specialize in carpet and upholstery cleaning, removing embedded dirt, stains, and odors with meticulous care. And they don't stop there. They also provide full residential and commercial cleaning services, from spotless homes to professional offices and more, all tailored to your schedule and your needs. Their professional team delivers reliable, high-quality results every time, leaving your space fresh, healthy, and welcoming. So don't wait. Visit SherlockHolmesCleaning.com or call them today at 774-772-5630 and experience a spotless home or office you can be proud of. Schedule now and let the experts find the problem and clean it right.
Mm-hmm. So your car's acting up again, huh? Squeaky brakes, weird noises, or that it's gonna quit on me vibe? Don't stress. Meineke has your back with locations in both Weymouth and Quincy. They'll fix it fast, keep it honest, and get you back on the road before your coffee even gets cold. Oil changes, tires, brakes, you name it, they do it. So stop stressing, start cruising, and leave the car drama to Meineke. Fast, friendly, and reliable. Meineke gets you back on the road in no time. For all your car care needs, trust Meineke. With two convenient locations in Quincy and Weymouth, stop by or call to make an appointment today. You'll be glad you did.
All right, we are back, and you are listening to the Francesca Luca Show. I'm speaking to Nicole Brown Simpson's ex-boyfriend, and we are talking about his book, Stalk. Welcome back, Keith.
Thank you.
So, before the break, I had asked you about her. I guess, you know, I'm trying to really, one thing I know for sure is that when a woman is badly abused by a man, you know, she can find herself in a situation that, you know, she didn't know snuck up on her. And some women have an easier time getting out of it than others. And oftentimes women who can't get out of it, it isn't so much a lack of self-esteem, but it's almost like they've been gaslit. Their abuser is making them think things about themselves that aren't true. And then they can get, you know, all sorts of confused and whatnot. But no, it's a long-winded question, but I would really love to know what you thought of her. I mean, I know you loved her, but did you ever think where is her sense of herself?
Well, I'll tell you a story about that. Nicole was seeing a psychologist, psychiatrist. I'm unfamiliar with the difference. I apologize for that. But while we were dating, and she was early on in the divorce proceedings, she was seeing a doctor who had her read a book called Women Who Love Men Who Hate Them. And we used to laugh about it. As she was reading this book, she was like, look at this. Look at the title of this book. And we were like, yeah, because we were going through it then. Mm. And starting to open up to me more about the prior beatings and the prior stuff. And I'm convinced that had they not had children, this would have never ended this way, that she would have broke free years before that. It was the family unit that kept her around after that. So once she had Sydney and then Justin, it was almost like a trap. I mean, I don't know.
And I hear you. I definitely hear you.
And you're right. You know, women get sort of duped into that and led to believe that they have a negative self-worth or a lower self-worth by the abuser. And part of the reason that I hope this book reaches some other women who may be in those situations is that I wanted them to see the signs that I talk about in the book and things that we went through and understand that if you're in a relationship where some of these things are happening, run, don't walk out of that, because it very seldom gets any better. And most often it gets tragically worse.
But you say that he hated her.
That's what the book title was.
Well, he probably did hate her. He probably hated himself, right? I mean, it's been so many years now. I mean, I do remember that Bronco chase on TV. I remember it. That was a lot of years ago. But, you know, it's the story has definitely faded in my mind. I mean, that was 32 years ago. So that was a long, long, long time ago. But, you know, he likely didn't think much of himself. And I'm not so sure if he... What was his obsession with her? Was it that he did love her, or do you think it was that he couldn't have her and somebody else? What was his gig?
I think it went through several of those stages that you just mentioned. I think initially he loved her. He loved her madly, I'm sure. But he also looked at her as a possession. Mm. Testimonies, one of which by her sister, Denise Brown, who talks about how OJ used to say things like, this is mine, you know, when referring to her, you know, body parts and, you know, I own my possession. And, you know, that's another phase of it. And then it got to a phase when she left him where he was losing control of that. And that's where I came in. That's why he hated me so madly, is because I stood up to him and there was a guy who wouldn't put up with him, you know, controlling her anymore. And I stood my ground and I said, I don't care who you are. You know, she's not your wife. She's single now. And that angered him. And I saw his eyes go black and his veins come out of his head several times in confrontations where I saw him morph into a different person. And she told me, I don't ever want to be left alone with him because you don't know what he's capable of. And I sort of shrugged it off at time. But in hindsight, it could have very well been me on several occasions when he could have, done what he did with Ron. And let's talk about Ron for a second, because I thanked him in my book. Ron started with my company shortly after I left. I left about 4 or 5 months before the murders. I had gone to Atlanta and I was in the process of opening a restaurant on my own, looking for locations. So Ron Goldman was hired during that period of time. Even though the restaurants were mine for all those years, I was in control of them. And I knew the whole staff at Brentwood. Ron was one of the new people. So didn't know him personally, didn't have any interaction with him. But in the book, I go out of my way, thank him, because I feel like Ron walked into a no-win situation and did his best to defend Nick and to save his own life and paid the ultimate price for it. And I just wish he would get more credit for what he ultimately did and suffered that night.
This must be, as I'm listening to you and it's bringing me back to it all, this must have really changed the entire trajectory of your life. Obviously, you know, you were never able to get, I mean, you're only, 65 years old, you're an attractive man, you've written a book, you're successful, and you haven't been able to take a relationship to the level that you ever had with Nicole. So right there, that has, so it affected you with that, which is big. I mean, that's huge, wouldn't you say?
100%.
Do you think that you will ever again find love?
That's hard to say. I don't discount that as a possibility, but I don't really seek it at this stage. I mean, it's hard to explain. I'm comfortable in my skin. Mm-hmm. I'm happy with who I am, mm-hmm. what I've accomplished in life professionally, and I've got a great group of friends that keep me grounded and have over the years. So I'm good with that. And I've become a little more spiritual late in life. Mm-hmm. I'm not worried about the ultimate end game. I actually am looking forward someday to seeing Nick again, like I said, and having a shot of tequila and reminiscing about the old times. I sort of feel that's the next big event in my life, and if that makes sense.
Yeah. So with all that had happened, how did that change? As I said, the trajectory of your life, obviously with love and romance, it seems pretty clear that that affected you. But how did you feel? You must have gone through all sorts of emotions, guilt, trauma, I should have protected her more, or, I'm not saying that that's what you're saying. I'm just saying these must have been all sorts of thoughts and emotions.
Yeah.
Right. I can't imagine you not being able to get professional counseling after such a thing.
Never did.
Oh, you didn't. So to work all that through, how did you manage to do that? Do you feel like you were ever really able to fully, I don't want to say resolve. I don't know that resolve is the right word. Maybe.
Well, I went through all those emotions over the year. I missed her. Mm-hmm. I loved her. I continued on with my life the best way I knew how. You know, it definitely changed the trajectory of my life professionally. I ended up in New York just sort of trying to hide out. I took a job I thought would be for 6 months while I was awaiting the trial to end, and I stayed 20 years there. So, you know, you wake up one day and now you're in your 50s, mm-hmm. and you think to yourself, wow, where did that go? And, everyone knew my story up in New York. The media was all over the place. They would write about me in the paper quite often, anything I really did. So I wasn't hiding from anything. And I also had that overbearing feeling that maybe something was going to happen to me someday. Maybe I'd look over my shoulder and he'd be there, or someone that maybe he paid to come after me. You know, New York's kind of a lonely, scary place at 4 o'clock in the morning when you're walking home from your bar.
Right.
And going to Park Avenue or side street, to get to your apartment. And, a lot of stuff goes through your head. So there's many a times I thought, maybe something could happen. And I've had nightmares over the years, not overbearingly, every day, every week, but there's been periods of time. Mm-hmm. And oddly, when I was starting this book project, I started having the nightmares again.
I don't know
if that was him haunting me from the grave or that was Nick warning me from the grave, but I certainly felt something.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you were looking back and you were, it was always in your subconscious and you were bringing it to the forefront. And then, there are probably many parts of the story that it always will remain to some degree unresolved. I mean, some things are just not able to be fully resolved. They're just not. I think there's just, you know, there are things that happen in people's lives that, you know, they can work it through. They can write about it. They can talk to someone about it. They can have supportive friends. But, you know, it's a tragedy. And
that's the way to put it. You're spot on that. And I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That Bronco chase was watched by millions. As I said, I remember it well. What was it like experiencing that, not as a viewer, but as someone personally connected to the story?
Well, I write about this in the book because it's a story that I never told until I wrote the book. But the Bronco chase was the day after the funeral. So after the funeral, we went back to Nick's house, her parents' house, where she grew up, for a small gathering of just close friends and family. So I was with Chris and Bruce Jenner and Faye and, you know, the gang. And we're all back there sort of celebrating Nick's life, but also having conversations about everything, about our thoughts and what was going through our minds. So I pulled Judita, her mother, and one of her sisters into a room and said, listen, I think I need to go to the police and tell them what I know. And they gave me their blessing. And I did several days later, which led to my grand jury testimony. But we had agreed at that event that the next day we were going to meet at Nick Bundy townhome where she was murdered and start packing up her stuff and inventorying her items and getting it out of there because the press had surrounded it and the looky-loos. And it was a madhouse scene. So I was staying two blocks from her condo in my friend's apartment. And so that morning I slept in a little the day after the funeral. It was the first time I had slept in 4 days since the murder. So I got over there about an hour later than everybody else, but they were already there doing their thing. And as I walked up the alleyway, the police let me through the barricade line. They knew who I was. I was just about to approach Nick's condo, townhome, and I heard screaming out of the top window. It was Denise, her sister, saying, Keith, just get out of here. Just go back to Ron's. Leave. And Ron Hardy, who was in there, my best friend, was screaming the same thing. So I didn't ask questions. I just turned and ran back to Ron's house. Now, this is before cell phones, so there was none of that instant communication that you normally get. So I'm standing back at my buddy's on pins and needles, not knowing what just transpired. And a little bit later, my friend came back and he's like shaking his head. He's like, dude, just as you were walking up, OJ called the condo and said he was on his way over to finish what he started. We didn't know if that meant coming over to kill me. I mean, he just stood next to me the day before at the funeral for 5 hours. We didn't know if that meant he was coming over to kill the Brown family, if he was coming over to kill himself. Nobody knew how to interpret that, but that was before he was wanted. So as my buddy's telling me this, in real time, we turn on the TV set and bam, there's Gil Garcetti. OJ's now a wanted man. He's a fugitive from justice. We are actively seeking him. There's a warrant out for his arrest, and everything transpired from that point. So before he was wanted and they were searching for him was when he was on his way over to the Brown to Nick's condo when he made that phone call. So that was my experience with the Bronco chase. So then we were just glued to the TV set. So you got to remember, we're two blocks from Nick's condo where she's murdered, but we're still only a mile from Rockingham, from OJ's house where he ultimately ended up going. So we're watching the whole scene on TV, occasionally sticking our head out the window looking at the 25 helicopters and hearing Renzo and being personally involved with it and right in the middle of it. So it was an almost an out-of-body experience for me to have to go through.
Is there a moment from that entire period of time in your life that still lives in your body, just not in your memory? I know that's a tough question. I'm just thinking, yeah. You know, do you have any kind of, because I mean, when you go through, I interviewed a doctor many years ago. He wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score. And when we do have very traumatic situations that occur in our lives, it's not uncommon to start to have physical sensations, unpleasant physical sensations, whether it being, you know, breaking out in hives or headaches or stomach issues or anything. And I was just curious whether or not physically, you know, you still carry any of this in your body. I know that's a pretty tough question, but.
Well, if you can manifest a broken heart, that's, that's one I can mention.
Yes, you can. So you have heart issues.
Yeah. And, you know,
you certainly can manifest a broken heart. Go ahead.
And then, you know, I lost a lot of sleep over the years and had a lot of physical, you know, toughness from waking up with nightmares and having flashbacks. And, you know, the physical strain that takes on you is something, but never anything to the extent of hives or that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd say heart disease is probably more serious than hives. Hives, you can always take Benadryl. I don't know. But anyway, you are watching the trial, not just as an observer, but as someone with intimate knowledge, obviously, of the dynamics involved. What was the most difficult witness during the proceedings?
Well, let me just tell you the caveat of that statement. I wasn't watching the trial. I was under subpoena and forbidden to follow the trial. So for the entire year, I was under subpoena first for the prosecution and then for the defense. So I did the right thing. I was told that I wasn't permitted to watch a trial, and I lived up to that end of it. Some people probably didn't, but I did. So I was unaware on a daily basis of how it was progressing. But, you know, you hear things when you're out and you see things in the paper. So I knew that it had turned. They had flown me out to be the first witness in the trial. They were going to open with domestic violence, which they ended up putting Denise on right before me and kept me in a hotel for a few days with the intention of putting me on after Denise. The way they explained it to me, the prosecution did, is they got a lot of information out of Denise that they weren't planning on getting out of her. So they were happy at that point. So they looked at me and said, we're going to send you home, stay quiet, keep a low profile. We're going to open this thing with domestic violence, Denise, and we're going to close with domestic violence, you, because we've got a lot of boring stuff in the middle with DNA and blood evidence and stuff. So we wanted to be emotional in the beginning, and we're going to be emotional at the end. And then we all know what happened in the interim with Mark Furman and everything turning on a racial issue and the jury. So when they got to the end, I think they just figured they were playing defense. I mean, I think the prosecution was on their heels after the Furman stuff. And I don't think they felt any kind of domestic violence evidence at that point was going to help. I think they may have even thought it was going to hurt. Put another, you know, lover on the witness with that jury having in their mind what they did about the racial component. So then the defense decided to subpoena me as a, in my opinion, a ploy to the court of public opinion. They were never intending to put me on the witness stand. I would have blown up in their face. But so I didn't get to watch testimony during that period of time. So I had to spend a couple of years really playing catch up. And when researching for this book, the chapter I write about the trial, I had to sit and go through everything with a couple of journalists that helped me out. And I knew from over the years that I looked at it. I looked at all the evidence, everything I could, as objectively as I could, almost as a juror. I didn't want to look at it as Nick's boyfriend. I wanted to see what they saw, the way they saw it, and try to understand how they came up with the verdict they did, which I'll never understand other than the racial component. So that's kind of where I stood as far as the trial goes.
If you could turn the clock back and not have had her in your life at all, would that have been better for you?
No, absolutely not. I actually use those words in the book. I say, you know, you can't turn back the hands of time, you know, turn back clock on the hands of time. But I don't regret meeting her. I don't regret the time we spent together. I don't regret the stalking incidents, you know, because that was part of what made our relationship what it was and what drew us closer together. I didn't enjoy those moments, obviously, but I don't regret them. They're part of what we went through. What I do regret is that I couldn't do more in two regards. One, to keep her from getting back with OJ and from making that mistake that I think ultimately cost her life. And two, I wasn't able to tell my story more in a court of law that might have swayed a jury. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced it would have at that point because they had made up their mind, but I wish I could have helped, and I wished more of what I knew could have helped point them in the direction of guilty.
All right, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about the verdict and the trial and whether it actually gave you the closure that hopefully that it gave you closure. So listeners, stay with us here. We will be right back. There's a certain feeling you get when you walk into Pioppi's. It's comfortable, familiar, like being welcomed by family. And that makes sense, because Pioppi's is a family business. Started right in Plymouth by Tony Pioppi after Prohibition, passed down through generations, and still run today by the same family. This is the kind of place where people take the time to help you, where questions are encouraged, where recommendations are personal because they actually get to know you. You might stop in for a bottle of wine and find yourself discovering a new favorite bourbon, checking out the craft beer wall, or browsing a humidor for hand-rolled cigars. For over 90 years, Pioppi has been about more than what's on the shelves. It's about pride, tradition, and taking care of the community they call home. Visit Pioppi's Package Store at 183 Court Street in Plymouth and follow them on Instagram and Facebook for new arrivals and events. So the next time you need a little whining, visit Pioppi's. Family owned, Plymouth rooted, no whining allowed.
Mm-hmm.
So your car's acting up again, huh? Squeaky brakes, weird noises, or that it's gonna quit on me vibe? Don't stress. Meineke has your back with locations in both Weymouth and Quincy. They'll fix it fast, keep it honest, and get you back on the road before your coffee even gets cold. Oil changes, tires, brakes, you name it, they do it. So stop stressing, start cruising, and leave the car drama to Meineke. Fast, friendly, and reliable. Meineke gets you back on the road in no time. For all your car care needs, trust Meineke. With two convenient locations in Quincy and Weymouth, stop by or call to make an appointment today. You'll be glad you did. Worn carpet fibers, ground in dirt, heavy use. When dirt settles deep into your carpets and upholstery, or when your home or business needs a complete clean, it takes experience, precision, and the right tools to get it right. When you need a cleaning detective, that's Sherlock Holmes Cleaning. At Sherlock Holmes Cleaning, they specialize in carpet and upholstery cleaning, removing embedded dirt, stains, and odors with meticulous care. And they don't stop there. They also provide full residential and commercial cleaning services, from spotless homes to professional offices and more, all tailored to your schedule and your needs. Their professional team delivers reliable, high-quality results every time, leaving your space fresh, healthy, and welcoming. So don't wait. Visit SherlockHolmesCleaning.com or call them today at 774-772-5630 and experience a spotless home or office you can be proud of. Schedule now and let the experts find the problem and clean it right. For 25 years, Andorra Salon has been making the South Shore feel beautiful. And today, it's also your destination for stylish women's fashion. I know because I wouldn't go anywhere else. Andorra is where I always feel my most beautiful. Discover a curated boutique filled with flattering, easy-to-wear pieces you'll love reaching for again and again. From casual chic to something a little more special, Andorra makes getting dressed feel effortless and fun. And when you're ready to complete the look, their experienced team offers expert hair and makeup services, personalized just for you, all in one relaxing, welcoming space. Located at 82 Main Street in Kingston, Andorra delivers an elevated fashion and beauty experience designed to help you feel comfortable, confident, and completely yourself. Visit AndorraSalon.com today. That's A-A-N-D-O-R. Salon and be on your way to a new you. Shop the boutique, refresh your style, love the way you look. You'll be glad you did. Cold shower surprise? Relax. Stefano Nagro Plumbing and Heating has it handled. From outdoor showers and high-efficiency water heaters to boiler replacements and full kitchen and bath remodels, they bring serious skill, sharp detail, and pride in every pipe. Got a plumbing or heating problem that stumped everyone else? That's their sweet spot. Water filtration too? Yep, covered. Every estimate comes with honest pricing, clear communication, and work done the right way. No funny business. Stefano Nagro Plumbing and Heating. Craftsmanship you can feel. Reliability you can trust. Visit StefanoNagroPlumbing.com. From first drip to final fix, done right.
All right, we are back and we are talking about Nicole Brown Simpson and OJ and speaking to the author of Stalked. Welcome back, Keith.
Thank you.
So the trial, you know, first of all, let's talk about the verdict. It obviously shocked many. How did it land with you?
Well, leading up to the verdict, like I said, I had some information on how the jury was, in my opinion, starting to formulate their what was going to be their decision. So I was about 50-50 the day of the verdict. I was hopeful that the evidence, the overwhelming evidence that had been presented, would keep them from making an emotional decision based on race and find him guilty. But I was also 50% worried that it was going to have no effect on them as far as the verdict. And obviously, we know the outcome of that. So I was crushed. I was angry. I was bitter. You know, all those emotions that you can imagine, you know, if you, you know, story, but I knew it was out of my hands at that point. I got a little bit of satisfaction out of him spending some years in jail in Las Vegas, to at least have him incarcerated for some period of time. Somewhat of a smile to my face. It wasn't long enough.
Yeah, it wasn't that long. How long was it? I don't recall.
I believe he served 7 years of a 9-year sentence. They paroled him. And then I was back to worrying about, you know, watching my back again once he was out on parole. But there was a period there where life was a little bit, you know, better when he was locked away.
You mentioned there are things in this book that you've never said publicly before without giving too much away. What kind of truth felt most important to finally tell?
Well, I talk a lot about Nicole's state of mind and things that Nicole told me about prior acts and their relationship. And, you know, I wrote the book. I'm a first-time writer. I had been offered book deals in the past. I never wanted to do it with a publishing house. I never wanted to have somebody else write my story. And when I decided to do this, I was very adamant that I wanted to tell it from a raw emotional kind of perspective. I didn't want it polished. I didn't want someone else formulating my words for me. I wanted to be like a walking journal.
Yeah,
I wanted
the
reader to go through
a memoir, basically.
Yeah, the story with us. I wanted, like, you were sitting on my shoulder feeling what we felt. And that's what I think the biggest thing about this book is. You know, people know my grand jury testimony. I'm not trying to, you know, re-script the trial and everything that happened. So some of the stuff is going to be familiar to people, especially people who followed the trial and the murders pretty closely. I'm not trying to rewrite history. What I'm really trying to do is give you that emotional attachment to us, to myself and to Nick and a little bit to Ron, to have you feel what it was like to be in that position and to go through these events and how it shaped us as people in our relationship and how it formulated me as who I am today.
How has writing the book changed you?
Or,
maybe it didn't, but, you know, I don't know. What did the book do for you?
Well, it gave me the outlet to talk about Nick, and that makes me feel good and makes me feel warm about that. It also gave me the outlet to, like I said earlier, bring up the fact to women who may be in these similar relationships that there is a support system out there, that there is help. A lot of it thanks to Nick's murder. You know, if something good came out of it, it's that domestic violence and abuse, domestic abuse became much more prevalent in society. And a lot of groups sprung up and a lot of support systems were created to help women leave these situations. So I wanted women who might find themselves in something similar to take this opportunity to try to get out of it and save themselves.
Would you, if you met someone who was in, let's just say that you met a beautiful woman that you were really attracted to, and, you know, she said she was in an abusive relationship and she's, you know, working her way out of it. Do you think that you would continue on with this woman? Do you think you would start to develop a relationship with her, or would you say, no, I'm not going down that road?
No, I think I would. And I think I would almost as a helper.
The rescuer. Yeah.
I feel like that. And there has been dozens, if not hundreds of women over the years that have reached out to me, many more since the advent of social media, because you can find me here,
right.
But who have reached out to me, who found themselves in horrible situations and knew my story with Nicole and told me flat out that I gave them the strength to get away from relationships because of how I tried to protect Nicole and how I was there for her, and it gave them the strength. And I'm incredible friends with numerous ones of those women. And to this day, I'm still great friends with several of them. So to answer your question, I don't think I would run from that type of relationship. I think I would probably be the helper and the, you know, the person who tried to.
And her sister, what was her sister?
Denise,
yeah.
She's a domestic violence book right now. It's not published yet, but she's in the process of it. Uh-huh. And she has chosen to focus more of her life's mission on the domestic violence angle. Mm-hmm. And good for her. I'm very happy for that.
So are you close to her?
Yes, absolutely.
Is she married?
She is not, but she is in a long-term relationship with a very great guy that she's been with for a long period of time. And she splits her time between Europe and Florida and has a wonderful life. And she's a great person, and she's always been an advocate, obviously, for Nick and everything happened, but more so for the domestic violence angle. So
something good. Well, I don't know if I could say something good came out of it, but.
Well, doing the best. She's trying to make as much good out of it as she can.
Exactly. If Nicole could hear this conversation today, what would you want her to know?
That I never stopped thinking about her, that I never stopped loving her, and I hope he could understand why I've chosen to spoke about some of these events, to give her a forum and give her a voice that she didn't have, and that she's looking forward to seeing me someday. I hope that's the case.
You believe in the afterlife.
I do more now than I ever did.
But did you at the time when you met her?
I don't think so. I don't think at 30 years old, the lifestyle that I was living, that had ever crossed my mind back then.
That's right. That's how old. I thought for some reason she was 37 when she passed. I don't know.
Well, when we met, I was 31 and she was 33. She was 2 years older than me. So 3 years later, I believe she was 36 when she was murdered, and I was 34, you know, when the murders took place, right around that period of time. But I was early 30s, 31 when we met. So,
I wasn't even thinking so young. I don't know why, but of course, yeah. Yeah.
And I had the restaurants going. So my jet set lifestyle, I talk a lot about that in the book. There's some crazy celebrity stories that are kind of interesting. And
We have a little bit of time left. Share one with us.
Well, just about, you know, my restaurants were very celebrity driven. My business partners in Los Angeles were Jack Nicholson and Don Henley in the Monkey Bar. So those were fun times with those guys. But, you know, imagine my restaurant in Aspen, Colorado. It was probably the number one celebrity restaurant at the time. Now there's many more. But back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, Mezzaluna really was the spot. So there's just, you know, so many stories of A-list celebrities. And then that carried on as I, you know, branched out and opened Beverly Hills Mezzaluna and Brentwood Mezzaluna, which is the famous one because of the murders, obviously. And then the Monkey Bar. When you talk about the Monkey Bar, which I opened in 92, that was just A-list craziness.
What was that like to be around all those celebrities?
It was a lot of fun, to be honest with you. They're cool people. They're talented people. They're all a little different in their own regard.
Well, they're artists.
They're artists, exactly.
I mean, artists are eccentric, you know. I was just having a conversation with someone
the other day about this. The good thing is, I had a little power myself. You know, celebrities got to eat too. So
that's right.
If you wanted a table in my restaurant, I'm the guy. You know, I'm the guy you had to talk to.
So that must have been fun.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I don't regret any of those years. There's a few celebrities I talk about in the book that, you know, weren't a very positive influence. A couple of them have passed away, so I felt a little safer saying, but, you know, I could have gone without meeting them because some of the stories that, of stuff they did over the years wasn't very positive, but they weren't necessarily friends of mine, just people I crossed paths with. But for the most part, 95% of every experience I ever had with any of these celebrities were positive, fun, and interesting.
So do you have any plans to write another book now that you have written one?
That's it. I'm done.
That's it. What was that experience like writing it? Well, you didn't actually write it, right? You had somebody write it for you?
No, I wrote it.
Oh, okay. I must have misunderstood. I thought that you didn't have anybody guiding you to write it. You'd never written a book before. Wow.
Never written a book before. I had a couple of friends who are published authors who helped me through the process as far as formatting and, you know, some grammatical stuff I was unclear on, but I basically took my stories out of my head, started to put them on paper, started to meld them into something I felt was readable. And like I said, it's almost like a journal.
Well, no, I understand that, but you didn't have an editor, anybody that, you know?
No, I had someone proofread it for me and just, you know, make some corrections as far as punctuation and grammatical stuff.
Right. Did you find it difficult to write the book?
Somewhat in the beginning, but it started to flow a little more as I felt, you know, the words kind of come out and get put on paper. I felt a little more comfortable with the process.
For people who think they already know everything about this case, why should they read your book?
Because like I said, they never heard the true story of what we lived and how we lived it and never got that emotional side. You know, it's very sterile when you sit before a grand jury and you say, we did this. This is how it happened. This is where OJ stood. And this is what he said. I mean, you can reread grand jury testimony and over and over. And also it contextualizes me as a person somewhat. So if you had any interest in Nick and my story, and that would naturally mean that you want to know a little bit more about me. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the book about my growing up, my experience in the restaurant industry, the Mezzalunas in Aspen, Beverly Hills, all the celebrity stories, you know, and then there's mm-hmm. the part about Nick and I and obviously how our relationship developed. And then there's there's my analysis of the trial, which no one's ever really heard because I didn't get to ever speak about that. But really what I thought went down during the trial and where I thought the prosecution made mistakes and where the defense probably gained ground. So you get all that in there. And then this little short ending about what my life's been like since the verdict.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it, Keith. Is there anything that you, any last bits of anything that you want to share with our listening audience before we say goodbye?
Well, I'd like them to know that the easy way to find out about the book and to purchase the book is to go directly to the book's website, mm-hmm. which it, unfortunately is not the title of the book. It was taken already. So if you go to ojstalkedme.com, all one word,
that's
the website. OJStalkedMe.com. If you go to that directly, we'll take you and tell you the synopsis of the book, a bio about myself. There's a lot of great pictures in there, tells you a little more information. And it also has two direct links that take you to Amazon because the book is available on Amazon. So,
all right. Well, Keith, thank you so much for being a guest on the show tonight. It's been really a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. You take care of yourself. Have a good night.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got to wrap things up and say goodnight. I hope you enjoyed the show. Super fascinating story. If you missed part of the show, you can hop on over to my iTunes page and listen there. The book, Stalked, isn't about revisiting a spectacle. It's about reclaiming humanity in a story that lost it along the way. So thank you for trusting us with it, and we'll see you next week. Same time, same place. Make it a great week.